Thank you. As you're getting settled, our next case is 823-1808. I hope I pronounced this correctly. Sheila Bursky versus the State of Minnesota. As all parties are aware, the appellant's counsel will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent's counsel will have 15 minutes. And finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So, counsel for the appellant, whenever you're ready, just approach the podium, adjust the microphone, and please tell us who you are in a loud voice. Thank you.
Good morning, officers of the court, counsel. My name is Teresa Paulson and I represent Sheila Bursky. This case comes down to corroboration and exculpatory evidence. Important is that our ask is for an evidentiary hearing. We are not asking for a full remand at this point. We posit to the court that we have met the burden, the basic burden that an evidentiary hearing should have been granted, which is a low standard under the law. This case presents new evidence and new law. I understand that the state's position is that some of this evidence, two of the pieces of evidence, would have been known to my client prior to the trial. And as part of the reason for the evidentiary hearing is we need to understand whether or not that new evidence also constitutes ineffective assistance of counsel. As detailed
counsel, I guess my preliminary question in this case is this really is your claim that this is new evidence in this post-conviction petition, or is your claim that there was a Brady violation because this evidence should have been disclosed earlier? Because it seems to me that those are two different standards that we would apply. Do you agree?
Yes, and I'm actually arguing that it's both. And this and that supports at an evidentiary hearing because either it's Brady or it's new evidence. There is parts of this that is new evidence, and there are parts of this that is falls under Brady. In a
parts of it also looked like it was evidence that would be available to the defense counsel, but didn't bother to get it.
And that's the ineffective assistance counsel portion of this as well. And that's why this is a this case poses some complex questions, which should have been handled at the district court level through an evidentiary hearing, because this is goes to a basic defense. Whether or not a person is eligible for medical assistance was a question that was posited to the jury. And there's an intent aspect to it, but there's also an eligibility aspect to it. And if Mr. Meinert was eligible, as we argue he was, then the transfer didn't matter because the transfer itself was not with the done with the purposes to obtain medical assistance. It would have an examination of what was the setting in 2005 for the creation of that. And that standard, that element, was not ever fully discussed to the jury. It was also, if it was available ahead of time, it was not addressed at all by the defense attorney. It was glossed over, is the nicest way to put it. But it comes down to there's a duty for every defense attorney to investigate. There is a duty to research the law. And as I've cited into my brief, this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court have said when an attorney fails to even read the law, then there's a violation of effective assistance of counsel. And so if it was available, then that creates a burden for an evidentiary hearing for the court to look into, well, is that an ineffective assistance of counsel?
Tell me how the trial judge handled that aspect.
The trial judge found that every single action that the defense attorney took in this case was covered as trial litigation strategy. Trial litigation strategy is a very much a protective shield for every defense attorney. But at the same time, in order to claim the trial litigation strategy, the attorney must show that they first considered that they did the work to evaluate whether or not that was a merit. There was merit to bringing that forward. Here we posit that the evaluation may not have occurred, but we don't know because we have not been given the opportunity for cross-examination and for an evidentiary hearing.
What does the case law say about when you can determine when you can determine that defense counsel's actions are trial strategy, as opposed to when you need to have a hearing to bring in the attorney to determine whether something is trial strategy. Because I don't know that our case law is completely consistent. And so I would be interested in where you think that line is for when you need to have an evidentiary hearing to evaluate whether something was trial strategy or not.
I was looking at more towards, for clarification on that point, I went towards the Brady line of rules and towards the Larison test towards that. Because when you weigh out the value of that evidence, and then you go in through whether or not there was a surprise to the defense attorney, then under Larison, that standard requires the evaluation of, was this a surprise? Was this alternative law a surprise to the defense? And in order to determine surprise, you have to get into the mind of the attorney.
But do you agree that in evaluating Brady, that Larison is the correct test? Isn't Larison the test that we apply to newly discovered evidence?
And
this is my whole question. I mean, is this a Brady question or is this a newly discovered evidence question? Because it seems to me that the district court has somewhat conflated the two standards in this case. And so I think it would help me to clarify whether we're talking about a Brady violation, which is this information should have been disclosed to my client prior to trial, or if this is newly discovered evidence, we've discovered new evidence and that would have impacted the verdict had we had it before. And I think that those are two different tests.
I think in order to evaluate that, you have to break this down into the three different counts. So when it gets to the eligibility, that's count one. The question about the eligibility is a question of mixed law and fact. And so the failure to produce that does trigger a Brady issue as well, because only a portion of it, breadcrumbs were left.
And that's the disclosure of the interview, the programs manual.
That's the entirety of the programs manual issue. So that is, that also has a Brady aspect to it. But the testimony that went in about eligibility is under the Larison test. Does that make sense? Because the Brady aspect of it is
false testimony,
as false, whether or not it was false testimony, because what the testimony elicited was that there was no exceptions and the state relied upon this. No,
just answered the question. It just didn't answer some other question.
I'm sorry.
You're talking about the attorney.
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
You're talking about the lawyer that was called to testify?
Yes, the lawyer that was called to testify answered.
I thought my reading of it was that the lawyer answered the question, but maybe didn't answer some other questions that should or could have been asked.
That's true as well. So in the solicitation of the evidence that occurred, and this is why it's a complex case, because something happened. We know something happened. And that's why we need the evidentiary hearing, because we have to narrow down what exactly occurred here. Either it was a question that was answered, but it presented the wrong impression to the jury that a person was ineligible when in fact there were standards of eligibility that applied, and or there was ineffective assistance of counsel, or there should have been more disclosure that occurred to get everybody on the same page as to what is the standard of eligibility so that the jury is answering the right question of fact. Because at this moment, the jury was presented a lot of evidence. There is no doubt about that. But the evidence that they were presented didn't actually get to the heart of the facts of this case. What they were presented as true about the policy manual left out that Mr. Minor was eligible because of the fact that his need for medical assistance, long-term care, was completely unforeseeable. I would also direct the court.
Could you finish your answer as to, you were saying that you think each count, you have to look at each one, and you said count one, Brady and false testimony. Could you finish your answer?
Yes.
On that?
So when you get to count two and count three, deal with the administration of a trust. And when you get into that exhibit 10 that was submitted to the jury with all of the transactions, you'll note that there are no payments for rent, no payments for electricity, no bill payments coming directly out of that account, which means when that undisclosed evidence came in, when that undisclosed interview happened, it meant that the state was in possession of not only corroborating evidence to the defense's argument that these were reimbursements, but that there was an exculpatory factor where under the law, she would have been right to reimburse.
So are we talking about the landlord's
The landlord's interview, yes.
And so do you see the landlord's interview as Brady evidence, as newly discovered evidence? Where do you put
that? I put into Brady altogether. Because not only, I understand the trial court's position that surely Ms. Bursky was aware that she had submitted evidence to this landlord.
But didn't the district court apply the newly discovered evidence test when they were making that finding? I mean, isn't the Rainier test the test that you apply for newly discovered evidence, not Brady?
That's true. So
didn't the district court just apply the wrong legal standard in evaluating the landlord's interview?
Yes. And with the district court went through our entire brief and said there was no Brady here. There was no implication of Brady. The conviction stands. They upheld the conviction, denied the evidentiary relief. And this case poses some serious questions about investigation standards, not only on the state side, but also on the defense side. And these questions that this case poses goes to the heart of effective representation of every single person and entity to a courtroom. And it was a Brady violation. But it's not about whether or not this was available elsewhere, because under this Brady violation, there was no notice at all to the defense that not only was one of their witness, did their witness conduct another interview, that witness received exculpatory evidence, received corroborating evidence. And there's a interesting case, State versus Pankity. It's not on all fours, 708 Northwest 2D185. The Minnesota Supreme Court in that case remanded for an entirely new trial when the state failed and the district court approved the turning over of supplemental government records that corroborated the defense's position. In that case, the Supreme Court said that it was a self-defense claim. And the Supreme Court said essentially that since a jury must make determinations of credibility, when there is corroborating evidence from the state, there is an additional duty to ensure that the defense has an opportunity to have their position corroborated through the state's evidence. Because otherwise, the jury is making credibility determinations based off of one side versus the other side. And even in our case law under post-conviction relief, the Court of Appeals, under the standard of review, is required to find every point in favor of the state at trial, and then any point that the defense raised as not merit-worthy, because we don't know what happens in a jury room. And because there was corroborating evidence at the state, it means that dismissal, that every single point that the defense raised, is unreliable at that point, because we have corroborating evidence that had the state disclosed it, this interview comes down to a disclosure that had the state disclosed it, there should have been an opportunity to cross-examine regarding the amount of funds. This person was told with specificity on several applications that they received certain amounts of money, that Mr. Minert was receiving direct financial monthly support from Ms. Bursky when it was payment of rent, electricity, utilities, you name it. And under counts 2 and 3, when you look at the analysis here, the analysis requires a jury to make another question of mixed law and mixed fact. And one of those questions is, was Ms. Bursky entitled to reimbursement? And when there was corroborating evidence that might be yes, Investigator Tutlin, who states, I think in the first or second page of this interview transcript, that he was directed by the state's attorney to take that interview. That's not a minor thing. The prosecution asked for that interview to be taken. And then with the non-follow-up on it and the failure to turn it over to the prosecution and then testify at trial, then it creates this injustice that not only do you have a Brady violation, but the refusal to turn over the corroborating evidence in this case made it so that Ms. Bursky's own words would not be believed on the stand. And that is a grave injustice, because when a jury hears each side, they have to make determine which person, which witness are they believing. And with that, the jury doesn't actually have the right standards of law to apply for them. So the,
I want you to finish your argument, but the question that's still bothering me is, not bothering me, I guess, but the inquiry I have, was the post-conviction judge the same judge that tried the case?
No.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Paulson. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll now hear first counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you. Thank you. Michael Schneider from the state. First, what I'd like to address, I didn't address this in my brief, but just in looking and preparing for oral argument, I did come across an unpublished case, 2021 Westlaw 957308, State versus Henline. And that case indicated, regarding counts two and counts three, a similar case where it was transfer of funds from a trust account into an individual's personal account. And on page six, they specifically referenced the specific amounts of money that were transferred from a trust account into a personal account of the trustee, and seemed to indicate that that was a sufficient basis. And I just wanted to address that. That was one point, I believe, that was raised in counsel's arguments. Another issue that was raised that I didn't put in my brief specifically, but again, in reviewing for oral argument, if we look at the transcripts, page 338 to 339 of the trial transcripts, there's a question that's asked of Ms. Bursky from her attorney along the lines of, it's fair to say that you didn't give money to the bank, you kept it when dealing with, they were first talking about the contract for deed and satisfaction of that. So the question was, it's fair to say that you didn't give money to the bank, you kept it all between you and Norman, and the answer is right. She admits that she fulfilled the contract for deed in 2011, and everything was done the way it should be, and that's why we have the warranty deed. And I think that's important to remember, because any kind of argument that there's no paper trail misses the point, because it's clear that Ms. Bursky admitted at trial that when she was dealing with Mr. Meinert and the contract for deed and transfer of funds, that there wouldn't be any kind of giving money to the bank, that this was something that was between the two of them. So I think what's important in this case, when we look at, and I understand this is a case with a lot of evidence, a lot of testimony, and it's a difficult case, but what we have to remember here is that this is a crime of omission. She failed to indicate on the satisfaction, she failed to report the satisfaction of contract for deed on the application form. And she should not get the benefit of any speculation favorable to her defense. She admitted that she was in real estate for quite some time. She admitted at trial, when she was asked that specific question, is a satisfaction of contract for deed considered a sale? And she said yes at that point. Further, we have admissions.
Could we focus on sort of the questions that we have posed here, which is whether, I think one of the big ones to me is whether there's a Brady violation here. And I was a bit confused by the district court's application of the Rainier test in evaluating the landlord's testimony. Do you think that the district court applied the correct test under our Brady case law?
I believe if we look at what the district court cited, they did cite United States versus Jones in the federal courts. They indicated when information is available to the defendant, it's not Brady material.
But that's when you bring a post-conviction petition for newly discovered evidence, is normally when this is applied. And my understanding of the argument that the petitioner has brought here is that this was an interview that was in the state's possession. They failed to disclose it, and therefore we analyze it under the Brady test as opposed to the newly discovered evidence test. And we have cases from the Minnesota Supreme Court like Whalen that explicitly talk about how Brady is a more favorable standard to defendants than the newly discovered evidence test in Rainier, because the burden on what the impact had to be at trial is lower for a Brady violation than for a newly discovered evidence violation.
I think when you look at the specific piece of evidence that's being addressed through the Rayner test was actually accurate. Because when we look at the evidence...
Did the state have the interview?
The interview, yes. And I outlined that.
Did the state disclose the interview?
Not prior to trial, no. And we conceded that.
And so isn't the analysis under Brady not newly discovered evidence?
I think it's a mixed evidence, as counsel indicated. I think it would be an analysis both under Brady and...
But do you think the district court did the analysis under Brady?
I think they did the analysis under Brady based on looking at United States versus Jones and State versus Bishop, another case they looked at. I think ultimately we get to the same point because this implicates both. This is a situation where it's not truly unknown evidence because they indicated that Ms. Bursky knew this person. She
provided. But is that relevant to the Brady analysis? That's my question. I mean, really what's troubling me about this is whether the fact that she knew this person is relevant under Brady or if that's only relevant if we're talking about newly discovered evidence. I mean, that's really what's troubling me is how do we look at the fact that she knew this person in the context of a Brady violation as opposed to a challenge that I found newly discovered evidence?
Well, I think if you look at the standard under Brady, the third prong of Brady is that the evidence still has to be material in that it must have caused prejudice to the defendant. I don't think anything in that interview specifically rises to the level of being material, at least as far as evidence that, again, she was, it's a mixed question because she was providing him the evidence and Mr. Volkmuth, the landlord, was simply testifying to evidence that he had received from her. So in that sense, she could have subpoenaed this person. She knew who this person was. She had business dealings with this person. I think what this comes down to is that material? And the state conceded that this was something that was not disclosed prior to trial. This was something, this individual contacted our office indicating he had some information about dealings with Ms. Bursky. I honestly was uncertain as to how relevant that would be. And, you know, with all the evidence that was coming in, I explained as to why that got overlooked, and I apologize for that. But when we look at the Brady violation portion, I think we have to focus on...
Mr. Schneider, why was the interview not material? Not prejudicial to Ms. Bursky?
Well, because I think most of what... I mean, the interview was based on information that she had previously provided to him in their business relationship. So she would have been aware of their business relationship with the documents she would have been provided to him and what he possibly could have said in regards to that. So I think it's a mixed question of Brady and Rainier based on the fact that this isn't someone who was completely unknown to the defendant at that point.
Well, let me try it this way. Was the information not material and not prejudicial because it had nothing to do with the original declaration relating to the contract for deed?
I think it didn't have anything to do with the actual the entry of the contract for deed or the fact that she didn't disclose that on the application as was required. So I think what we have to bring this back to again is the jury instructions.
So I take it the landlord would not have testified. Well, this interview that was not disclosed, nowhere does it say, oh, by the way, she did disclose this on the affidavit.
I don't think anything that comes out in the Volkmuth interview is material because it doesn't affect any of the actual evidence that was admitted that the state relied on to provide.
I had one question. It wasn't clear to me from the record, and it might not be relevant to the arguments, but I know there was a satisfaction filed for the contract for deed. Was there any evidence as to whether the $510,000 was ever paid?
The evidence in that is, this goes into a situation as to should she be getting any speculation favorable to her defense for not disclosing that. So she made admissions both at the interview she gave to law enforcement and at the trial that this was satisfied in full. There was documents indicating that were filed after this was satisfied. So the presumption is that with the information that she gave us, there was no reason to believe that this wasn't. And the argument that I made, my closing argument is we weren't arguing that there was any wrongdoing in the satisfaction of the contract for deed. We were clear that I made that argument in my closing argument because I wanted the jury to be aware that we were agreeing with Ms. Bursky, that we believed her when she said this was paid and this was satisfied. She said that in her statement. She said that at trial many times. And documents were filed after the fact that indicated that, that the warranty deed was given, that, that this was something that was satisfied. So that's what we're relying on, is based on her own testimony and her own statements in that regard. And what's important to note as well, that the contract for deed did have a payment schedule within the contract for deed. It indicated as to how much was to be paid on a regular basis. And this is a contract for deed that was satisfied 6 years into a 30-year contract for deed, well before it had to be. The presumption that this was done for eligibility.
The deed was delivered.
Correct. Okay. Correct. So this was a contract for deed that was satisfied well before it had to be. 6 years into a 30-year contract for deed. Mr. Minert was already in his late 60s at the time that he, in 2011, when he applied for services. So the presumption applies that this was done for the purposes of eligibility. The only way you get over that presumption is to present convincing evidence at the time to say that it wasn't. And again, she should not be given any speculation favorable to her defense for the non-disclosure, because the presumption that this was done for eligibility purposes remains, because this occurred during the workday.
We're really here talking about the merits of this case, right? I mean, we're here talking specifically about whether there are Brady violations, whether it was false testimony, whether the jury instructions were correct, and whether there was effective assistance of counsel. Correct. I mean, it's not, I understand that the merits are important, but really we're here and we need to target those issues. And I have a couple of questions with respect to the healthcare programs manual. I think that you say this in your brief, but I just want to be clear. That's a public document, correct?
Correct. All the healthcare public documents, you can go online right now and find them. They're not confidential.
And do you, I think that your argument with respect to the programs manual is that the defense attorney could have gone online, could have read these exceptions, understood that these exceptions existed, and therefore the state didn't have any obligation to disclose it.
And we did disclose many portions of the healthcare policy manuals that are in existence at the time. That's something that we need to clarify. There was an order previously, a year before that, for us to disclose specific notes from specific eligibility workers, and we did that. There was no, or a year after that order was, we satisfied that order. Then we voluntarily, before trial, disclosed the policies that were, relevant policies that were in effect at the time. And that was just done for the assistance of counsel. And those indicated that, again, those were public documents that could have been accessed anywhere. And that was something that, that again, we're not required to disclose statutes, and we're not required to disclose anything that's available to the public, such as healthcare policy manuals. But in this case, the state did anyway, just to
help. That raised the question at the post-conviction hearing as to what possible strategy could be involved in not digging that out. Possible strategy could the defense lawyer have had in not finding or even looking for the rest of this material that hadn't been disclosed?
Isn't
that the issue for the evidentiary hearing at post-conviction?
I don't believe so, because that information, again, was disclosed. But when you look at the information there, what this comes down to is speculation.
But your argument is that trial counsel could have looked at the exceptions. Right. And then with respect to ineffective assistance of counsel, you're saying it was trial strategy if he didn't look at the exceptions. And it seems like that's normally why we have an evidentiary hearing, is to bring defense counsel up to say, I did look at the exceptions and I didn't think any of them applied, or whoops, I didn't realize that there were exceptions. And that's the reason why we generally have an evidentiary hearing, especially around issues of ineffective assistance of counsel, to determine whether or not it was trial strategy or whether the attorney made a mistake.
I think the answer to that is that when we start going into the healthcare policy manuals, what we're looking at then would be, was there eligibilities for exceptions here in this case? That's what that comes down to. And I think, again, we only get into exceptions if this was something that would have been reported at the time and we could have looked at exceptions. The objection from the state to any going down that would have just been that that's not relevant. When I asked my witnesses on direct questions, I didn't open the door to exceptions. The jury didn't hear that. I didn't ask any of my witnesses, isn't it true there aren't any exceptions? That line of questioning didn't occur, and the order from the court indicated that when I spoke specifically to Ms. Reverman, she was asked about the spend down policies, and then the court indicated she was not asked.
But wouldn't the questions. Exceptions be relevant to her guilt? I mean, if she did satisfy an exception, then wouldn't a defense counsel have an obligation to have investigated whether an exception applies, because that would mean she's potentially not guilty of the offense. I mean, that's what we're talking about with this, in with her ineffective assistance of counsel claim, right?
Our argument is you only get to the exceptions if this would have been something that would have been reported at the time. This is a crime of omission. And again, when I come back to, it's not a perfect analogy, but I would draw an example to, let's say, a DWI refusal. The crime itself is a refusal. The defendant wouldn't be allowed at appeal to come and say, well, had I blown into the DMT machine, I would have been under 20 void anyway. That's kind of the analogy we're getting into here is exceptions. She's trying to say that, well, had I declared this, look at all these exceptions I could have applied. This is a crime of omission, and I think we have to focus on that. But she knew she had the obligation to report this. She admitted it at trial. She didn't report it. And for her to actually be able to open up the door now and to go back into healthcare policy manuals and say, well, I would have, theoretically, I could have had this exception or that exception, that goes beyond what the scope, that just goes beyond the scope of what this is. This is a crime of omission because she closed that door and not declaring that, and she admitted at trial she knew she had the obligation to do so.
Thank you. I think your time is expired. Thank you very much. Ms. Paulson, you'll have the last word. Just give us a minute to reset the timer.
And it would be helpful to me if you'd start by responding to his argument that the exceptions don't really apply because she didn't report this on the form.
Noted.
Go right ahead, Ms. Paulson.
So under the legislative construct of these rules, nowhere are these eligibilities written into any of the rules, any of the policy manuals. There has been no citation of a limitation in time. That's the beautiful thing about this eligibility issue, is that it is something that can be analyzed again over and over and over again. And in fact, you see that in the transcript and under Ms. Rockbauer's affidavit. Because in the transcript, and I think I cited, I know I cited to it in my brief, but in the transcript, the eligibility worker talks about how they didn't do the asset verification. They didn't even look at the form when in June of 2013. And so they were supposed to do an asset verification. And when you go back to the rules, on the administrative rules, 95.0135, it's the agency that has delegated all the responsibility. So what happened in this case is you have a ripple effect. And this is where two of the other pieces of evidence are important. The CMS letter, the letter of subrogation, or the letter that was sent to Mr. Meinert's farm address, and the insurance card, because the state knew. The state always knew about this. And because the state knew, the way they got that information was because of the county's own work, because that application is like throwing a pebble into a pond, and it creates a ripple effect, not only at the state level, but at the federal level. And so these eligibility issues, they're not limited in time. And because we're talking about-
I want to make sure I understand. Are you saying that all of this evidence, well, did she or did she not have an obligation to speak truthfully as to the contract for deed? I mean, is there some exception you're saying that would suggest she didn't have to say that?
The form only gives notice under penalty of perjury. It doesn't give notice under the statutes. So she's filling out that form with the trial testimony shows.
So is there an exception that would have enabled her under the statutes you've been citing to us to not disclose that $510,000 satisfaction of the contract for deed?
Under the rules for, if you go through 19.4 under the health policy manual, there is other evidence that shows that the contract for deed information might have a different valuation date. Again, that would have been an issue handled at the evidentiary level. But if there is...
Who cares about the valuation date, though?
She
didn't disclose this. Are you suggesting that that doesn't seem to be an exception that I'm trying to get at, Ms. Paulson?
Well, the exception is, the exception that's listed in the statute is that it's for the purposes of defeating the eligibility. And it's the purposes of acquiring the funds. And so since the purpose, since the intent has to be, the omission is made to access funds that would otherwise not be eligible. So if he is eligible, then the omission is harmless.
Would you also explain why the landlord's interview was material and failing to disclose it was prejudicial to your client?
One, in the interview, it shows that Ms. Bursky did notify the landlord when she was applying for the elder waiver on that rent, that she did notify the landlord of the contract for deed in 2009. She had notified him. The other aspect of it, as it goes to counts two
and three. So in the exact interview that wasn't disclosed, you're saying she did disclose the contract for deed to the landlord?
She did.
Okay, well, why is that? Who cares?
Well, that's important because it shows that she is being honest about
it. I mean, the requirements are not to disclose it to the landlord. The requirements are to disclose it to the state, right?
Well, it...
Am I right about that?
Under that form, under the form for the state, the way that that promissory question is written doesn't actually include the word for contract for deed.
Well, I know, and I know that, but I mean,
so that's part of the argument here.
I have to admit, I'm a little dense on this subject. So what in the landlord's interview was prejudicial and material?
It goes to counts two and three.
Okay.
Counts two and three.
Not count one.
No. Okay. Count one has to deal, and I'm almost up, but count one deals with.
We'll give you the extra time to answer that question, okay. Please.
Count one deals with the policy manual eligibility. And if they're going to disclose part of the manual, you might as well disclose all of it and figure out, is this actually an effective assistance of counsel, right? The interview itself goes to counts two and three, the corroboration of the exculpatory evidence. The exculpatory evidence here corroborates Ms. Bursky's statements that she was providing direct financial support. And it was at a tune of a substantial amount each month, through rent, through electricity, through all of this stuff.
Well, I mean, what does that have to do with taking it? Okay, fair enough. What does that have to do with, dipping into the account for her own benefit?
Because if she's entitled to a reimbursement, she is entitled to reimbursement. It's not even an if. Under conservator and guardian laws, she is entitled to reimbursement of the funds that she spends directly for Mr. Meinhardt's benefit.
And did she keep logs indicating what those expenses were to sort of track the transfers from, you know, that account to pay the...
That's the ledger at issue that I cited to, where the defense attorney said on the record he wasn't certain why it wasn't disclosed to... That ledger wasn't disclosed to the state. So this really does come down to a question of, was it an effective assistance of counsel? And
so again, the but presumably, you know, the testimony at trial was, I don't see how the landlord's testimony helps you even on counts two and three. You're saying he would have said that she said to the landlord, you know, she's paying for all these things.
It was right? More than a statement. It was an actual form that she filled out, and she had to fill out every single year as to the direct financial support and how she was financially supporting Mr. Minor. And that would back up the testimony that she was trying to give, and the ledger, the undisclosed ledger that the defense had in its possession, about what she was financially spending on Mr. Minor and what, and that the transactions would have been entitled to reimbursement.
And ledger form was never introduced into evidence.
No.
Do you raise the ledger as part of your ineffective assistance of counsel?
I do. I actually, in my brief, I listed out 12 points on where the ineffective assistance of counsel pops into here.
May I ask one other question?
Go right ahead, Judge Larson.
I have a question with respect to the jury instruction. I think that the district court's analysis of the issue is that it may actually have been harmful to your client if they had given the instruction that you're asking for, because it could have been two different there could have been two different charges and that in terms of sentencing could have been more detrimental
on the aggregation
yep. issue. Why is that wrong? And if it's not wrong, then why isn't that the correct analysis under plain error review?
Under the plain error on that one, the aggregation here is incorrect because since a guardian and conservator is entitled to reimbursement, then the jury would have had the fact-finding mission to first determine what of those funds weren't applied or were applied to Mr. Reinhart directly for his benefit. And under that, then they have to do the determination of what is the value then, right? So the jury just being sent with a mission of look at all of these transactions and then just count them up. That's how the instructions could be read as well. And since there wasn't any narrowing on the instructions that a conservator and a guardian is entitled to reimbursement, then the jury, in clumping all of that together, may have included lawful transactions with what the state argues is unlawful. We're arguing that all of the transactions were lawful, but that also goes back to the interview. We have corroborating evidence that Ms. Minor or Ms. Bursky is spending her money on Mr. Minor, and the state's position then essentially is that no guardian, no conservator is entitled to reimbursement of the out-of-pocket costs that they incur. And that becomes a legal absurdity because people with fiduciary duties everywhere spend money directly out of their account and expect to be able to be reimbursed.
I get the impression that the jury couldn't find its way out of the weeds with all of the detail that exists here, with money going one place, going somewhere else, some being accounted for, some not being accounted for. Do you have a reaction to that?
Well, you know, it's tough being a district court judge, but I think with every, I wouldn't know, but I imagine that it's tough being a district court judge. But the great duty that we entrust in our judicial officers is that they will write instructions sufficient that it will create a roadmap out of those weeds so that the jury can ask those fact questions of themselves, argue them out, and then apply the law in a way that makes sense.
Thank you. I don't think we have any questions. Thank you, Ms. Carlson.
Thank you for giving me the extra time to answer the rest of your questions.
Thank you. The matter is submitted. We'll issue our decision within 90 days.